Hey, it's Bob and Elvis Show. Bob Seska here, Pennsylvania. Elvis Dingledean there in Nebraska. Another podcast. Hey.
Hi.
So we're going to dive right into this because we were talking before the show began, just really getting into this, just a bunch of things that happened on the Glenn Beck show that I hadn't really planned on talking about, but goddamn, they're insane. So we're gonna dive right in. So we're talking about this ridiculous thing with Glenn Beck, the Apollo mission versus the Woodstock generation, I guess, or the Woodstock concert, which how America can be divided along those two lines. Well, yes. I mean, how this came up, other than being silly and stupid and a false dichotomy, is we got a tweet here at reminding us that evidently Glenn Beck ripped that off from Ayn Rand. I mean, that is actually the case. I mean, it's from Roger Fahey. I'm sorry about that, Roger. Roger
Fahey.
There you go. Fahey.
Probably don't want to go too far with that name.
No. But, I mean, he pointed me to a link on the Ayn Rand Center for Individual Rights.
Oh, I love them. They do good work.
Yeah, good people.
Yeah. You know what? They actually, that institute actually co-opted my local newspaper's editorial column at one point until I started a vigorous letter-writing campaign to get that shit shut down.
Nice.
Yeah. They had guest, they would call it a guest opinion, and then they would have this essay, and down at the bottom in very, very small print, probably the smallest print possible, it said, this is reprinted with permission from the Ayn Rand Institute of personal, you know, up your own assness. And I was like, what? In this small town, this God-fearing heartland, you know, they're reprinting screeds from this atheist, this nutbag. So I started a vigorous letter-writing campaign, not under my own name, by the way. But I'm pretty sure everyone knew it was me. And that was the last we ever saw of that. Because I went for the churches first.
This all of the Ayn Rand organizations, and there are many, yes, including the Libertarian Party and just various rank-and-file libertarians. I mean, I've said this before, but it bears repeating in the context of this conversation. It's like the political equivalent of Scientology. These are people who just read these books, mm-hmm, like the L. Ron Hubbard books.
Yeah.
And turned and
spawned into it.
Yeah. Spawned it off into this big bullshit thing that barely holds any water.
Yeah. Oh, it holds no. It's a great thing. I mean, it's great in theory, if you want to even say that, but in actual practical reality, it's complete horseshit.
Yeah, it's great in theory if you're like a 17-year-old doofus, yes, who like, yes, oh yeah, I'm me and I'm against the world. No, you're not going to hold me down.
Right.
I'm a
went through that phase.
Yeah.
I actually went through a libertarian phase. It was completely up my own ass that exactly that way. And then you kind of wake up and you go, oh wow, there's a real world out there. Oops.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, we all go through that. I mean, being a Rush fan, I really enjoyed the earlier works of Rush, which were kind of inspired by Ayn Rand, but not so much in a political sense, but more in terms of, you know, sort of just individual, you know, sort of individuality and being yourself. And you know, it was just from the perspective of, you know, here was an angry drummer who wanted to be just, you know, kind of separate himself from the rest of the world in kind of a way. And so that's where it all kind of came from. And that's all fun for about 5 minutes, but goddamn, you grow out of it at some point.
Exactly.
And, exactly. You know, and in fact, this whole conversation of the Apollo mission, either you're a supporter of the Apollo mission or the Apollo program, or you're a Woodstock hippie, yeah, is actually relatable to the Rush, the epic Rush song Hemispheres, because then there's the connection with this Ayn Rand piece about Apollo and Dionysus, and you know, it's just so silly. But it doesn't shock me that Glenn Beck is horking without attribution material from Ayn Rand, because Glenn Beck kind of does that a lot. I mean, he's just kind of borrowing, you know, philosophies.
Well, that's all
from,
he does. I mean, yeah. In fact, I'm starting to see. I'm reading this book about the faiths of the founding fathers and about the role of religion and the historical religion, the historical precedent for separation of church and state, the things that had gone before the revolution. And I swear to God, this is the book that I swear to God, Glenn Beck has read that book and just picked out the parts that suit his own philosophy. That's what he does. I think he reads probably a lot more widely than we think. He just cherry picks the stuff that, you know, work for him, because this book, right in the introduction, this book, the author says, look, the left isn't right about this, and the conservative, you know, Christian right isn't right about this. There's a middle. There's a creamy, nuggety center in the middle there that is a little bit of the left's argument, a little bit of the right's argument. But Beck just takes this book and just cuts the parts out from the right and just says, hey, look, I'm right about this. So right. He's just so insidious with his punch me face.
Yeah.
So insidious.
Yeah, well, I mean, who's this guy, Cleon Skuzin?
Reads
that stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's all like weird fringe stuff that he kind of tries to whittle and shoehorn into whatever the hell it is he's talking about. Yeah. And, you know, obviously with the intention of scaring the living piss out of people who watch his show.
That's all it is. Yeah. It's exactly. Like that thing I was talking about last week, why 2012? Why 2012? Ooh, 2012, Mayan cow. Ooh. It's like, it's all scare tactics. And that Skusen guy, the guy that wrote the 5,000 Year Leap or whatever the name of that book was, that he was crazy. He was ostracized in his own day by the far right fringe of his own time. I mean, like the far right fringe that exists, that, you know, that we would think is really far right today, thought that guy was nuts.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, William F. Buckley thought he was a conspiracy loon. I mean, just
And that's saying something,
right? So, I mean, here's what Glenn Beck said about Woodstock versus the Apollo mission.
The house divided against itself cannot stand.
What?
Divided we stand, divided we fall. All right, we're a split nation. Well, what happened? I believe it was the summer of 1969. Which event was more important? Woodstock, the summer of love, or the moon landing? They happened within 3 weeks of each other.
Wow.
For me, anytime I would think of 1969, I think of the moon landing. I've never thought of Woodstock. I mean, loser city is what I think of.
Wow. Losers.
And 69 wasn't the summer of love.
No, it wasn't.
I mean, it closed it. Woodstock is basically what closed it out, but it started in 67, so.
Right. Off. Right.
But yeah, what happened? How did we get here? Well, it's Apollo and Woodstock. Well, that's how it all started. It has nothing to do with Nixon and the Southern strategy and Goldwater and the collapse of, you know, the silent majority. And it's Woodstock and Apollo.
Well, it makes absolutely well, I mean, on the surface, you could say, well, if you really want to simplify the world, you could whittle it down to these two things. But then you break that down and it's nothing. And it's so easy to break down because, like, for example, I'm much I can relate much greater to the Apollo missions than I can to Woodstock.
Yeah.
I have some very strong feelings about Woodstock. Not a big fan of the Woodstock.
The Woodstock.
The Woodstock.
And babies.
Right. I mean, I have some resentment there towards the Woodstock people, because I think they all kind of grew up, and this is sort of generalizing, but nevertheless, I mean, I think they grew up and they sold out, and they you know, they ended up becoming middle management and CEOs and all the douchebags who we kind of all hate right now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I have some deep-seated resentment towards the whole Woodstock crap and the hippies and all that shit. But, you know, so, I mean, but I'm just about as liberal as they come. So how do I fit into Glenn Beck's little stupid dichotomy?
Yeah. You've really got to be playing to a deep, deep, you know, an old anti-hippie base there to go to that well. I mean, that, it just seems so nonsensical, something that was you know, 41 years ago. The you got to go that deep to the well. To, like, what? Who is his audience? A bunch of, you know, 70-year-old, yeah, goddamn hippies, get a job. Who got riled up by that? I can't see my local wingnut going, yeah, Woodstock, fuckers. It just seems like you got to go really deep. You got to go to the real deep well to get some fervor started there.
Yeah, I mean, and Glenn Beck goes on. I'm not going to play this whole clip. But Glenn Beck goes on to claim that Americans study Woodstock more than they study the Apollo program. Yeah. Which, I mean, where? How? Where do you get this? I don't know. I understand that. I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, I don't remember ever reading anything about Woodstock in school.
Unbelievable. So
that's one of his things, though. That's my local wingnut is all about, oh, I got to read this and that because they didn't teach us that at school. I'm like, right, because it's crazy.
Yeah.
Of course they're not going to teach you that. They didn't teach us this in school. They didn't. I get this whole email about how Patrick Henry, they don't teach you anything about, they teach you give me liberty or give me death, but they don't tell you what he said before that and what he said after that. I was like, because it's irrelevant. He gave that speech in a church, so of course it's going to sound like a sermon. Of course it's going to have the word God in there. It's one of these emails about how the founders were so godly and Christian. And meanwhile, Patrick Henry wasn't a founder, so fuck off. I don't want to hear about he said God a few times before he said give me liberty and give me death, because he was a constitutional dissenter. They wanted him to go to the convention in Philadelphia, and he said no, because he thought the Constitution was a bad idea. So that's why he got shit-canned. It's, you know, that's why they don't talk about it that much, because he's irrelevant. I gotta go look at my daughters. I'm gonna homeschool my kids now because the textbooks don't teach what Glenn Beck thinks they should. Oh my God.
Well, see, I mean that's a real hang up of mine, because, well, I got a lot to say. I don't want to go off on the tangent of homeschooling right now.
Mm. I know.
Hey, you mentioned homeschooling, and I go, hold on a second there. And but speaking of home, Glenn Beck also had a little back and forth with his wife, which he talked about. Isaiah dragging his wife into the. I'm going to do a ridiculous and annoying impression of his wife in a minute, which I'm not going to do that. But as you probably heard, arguably the most annoying Glenn Beck radio show clip ever in the history of Glenn Beck radio show clips, where he was doing that. Well, it was either him or his stupid morning zoo sidekick. Yeah. Doing this Malia Obama voice. That's
him.
I mean, I've been able to tolerate a lot of Glenn Beck clips where I can just sit and listen to it and go, oh my God, this guy's full of shit and he's wrong. And
but that was beyond kind of crazy.
But it was beyond, not only in terms of just basic decency, but just the annoying voice. It was just, it was so grating and so agitating to listen to. I mean, fingernails on the chalkboard barely begins to scratch the surface in terms of how annoying this Malia Obama voice was that he was doing. But so you know, Glenn Beck in his melodramatic way sits down, you know, on his show on Monday, sits down on, oh, maybe it was Tuesday, sits down in his little white chair, and he's got his kind of campy 1950s television set next to him. He's just, it looks like he's on the crapper, really. I mean, it looks like he's got a television in his bathroom. You know, he's got his elbows on his knees with his stupid sneakers. And he goes into this this thing about how his wife called him for being the, you know, kind of the dick that he is.
Jag off that he is.
Yeah. So, I mean, he got in a fight with his wife. Here's Glenn Beck talking.
Hello, America.
Hello.
I want to talk to you about something that there isn't a TV executive or consultant or a PR person or an attorney or anybody that is in their right mind that would advise me to do. But it has to be done.
He's a rebel. He's a rebel.
You know, Al Franken used to do this great thing on his radio show with George W. Bush clips. Every time he would take a clip of George W. Bush speaking, you know, extemporaneously or even from a prompter. And in all of the pregnant pauses, Al Franken would play the sound effect of a Mack truck honking its horn and just screeching through. It's like, paws large enough to drive a truck through. That's Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck does it for a different reason than George Bush. George Bush did it because George Bush couldn't speak any longer than a few sentences without, you know, like sort of winding up his brain again.
Glenn, going, oh my God, I'm president. Oh my God, I'm president.
That's right. Glenn Beck does it, of course, for dramatic effect.
Well, that and to pad his show. I mean, if he took all that, because there's only so far, you know, crazy can go. So he's got to pad his show out a little bit.
Right, right. So
it's counterintuitive for me to bring this up, especially if you know the way the press works. It was a 3-day weekend. If you want to bury a story, and that's why, what is it?
He's pointing to his
item number 8 or item number 5. The FTC come out with a report on.
If you could see this. And sometimes I wish this was a video based show. Sometimes, yeah. Only sometimes. He's pointing to his chalkboard, and now this. So they cut to a shot of the chalkboard. There must be 9 things and about 100 words on this chalkboard. None of them are legible from the view that I'm looking at least. So he's pointing to number 8, and number 8 says, I can't even tell what number 8. I don't even know which one is number 8 because there's a big Fox News logo right. Covering it up.
Probably probably socialism or adult diapers. I'm going with one of those.
How to save journalism. They released it on a Friday. It's called a story dump.
Okay.
Eddie, have you plugged the hole yet? I was making fun of the president.
Yeah.
No, you weren't.
No, I wasn't. Not really.
Oh, my God!
You agree! Oh, my God. A hole is going to open up in the earth, and you're about to get sucked down. Oh my God!
I hadn't even seen that clip, and I got him to agree with me.
Right,
but I also broke my own rules.
He heard Dingledorf and
Dingledorf
changed his tune.
Yeah, I brought his children and his family into it.
Yeah. Since when is a president not allowed to mention the fact that he has children?
Yeah, yeah. He wasn't using that. I mean, it was. I'm not. I can't do it. I've had no coffee for a week. I can't talk about Glenn Beck.
Well, that's why. Now we got to get into this. Why the hell have you decided to stop drinking coffee?
Well, I told you, I'm clearing the way of one toxic. You know, I need to put more alcohol in my system, and the coffee seems to be negating those effects. So I'm moving on to tea, and then from tea to water, and then hopefully, you know, at the end of this process, I'm on an all alcohol based liquid intake. But here's an interesting thing. This is also the first full week of no beef, no red meat, no pork, no fowl, no, you know, nothing but seafood. Here's how my world works.
And Nebraska known for its bountiful seafood.
It is indeed. Yeah, you can get some real fresh stuff here in the exact middle of the country. So about as far away from, you know, a natural body of water as you can get. So yeah, the seafood's plentiful. But here's how the universe seeks to balance itself out. So I'm doing this because, you know, Food Inc. and I'm just distraught over what it is I'm putting in to the system. I don't know what, you know, I didn't like the way they, you know, the animals are just all crammed into places. So it's really, it's not because I'm like a PETA nutcase, but it has to do with just factories and I you know, steroids, antibiotics and all this stuff they put in it. So I'm driving to work yesterday. I'm tootling on to Omaha. It's a 45-minute drive, da da da, and thinking, oh, yeah, I'm very proud of myself, no red meat. And out of the corner of my eye, I see what I think is an enormous dog headed for my vehicle, the truck of infinite sorrows. It looks just like an enormous dog. And I'm on a 2-lane highway, which most of my commute is just this shitty 2-lane highway. And I'm da-da-da-da-da. It turns, it's a baby cow. It's a calf. And it's headed right for my car. Runaway cow. So in other words, when I try to stop eating beef, what the universe will do is you're going to kill cows one way or another. You're either going to eat them or you're going to run over them with your truck. So it's just one or the other. I have no choice but to do harm to bovines, basically. So I might as well. After that, I just barely missed it. Just barely missed clipping this calf in the skull with my truck. So I thought, you know, I might as well just go get a burger now because If I'm not eating beef, I'm just going to be hitting random cows.
Well, I was going to say, you took the little silver flask out of your shirt pocket. Yeah. And...
Boy, that was a close one. I better have a drink.
This is a drastic move. I mean, this is, I haven't even eliminated poultry. I mean, I still eat poultry.
No,
I still eat turkey.
I'm doing this in stages. If I can find a farmer's market with farm raised, you know, non Tyson, non processed, that's really my whole deal. I haven't gone to the, I can find free range eggs pretty plentifully. So I'm not going off eggs so much, but if I can, you know, it's just, I'm not buying store packaged, corporate, corn-fed anything. So
and then simultaneously, you're also cutting out coffee.
Yeah.
And what you're going to cut out
soda
and soda. Well, soda makes sense.
Yeah.
Soda makes sense because soda is basically acid with high fructose corn syrup. It's high fructose corn syrup flavored acid.
Yeah, and I'm trying to reduce. I'm literally shopping for. I mean, if it doesn't have a seal on it that says no high fructose corn syrup, I won't buy it. Whether it's bread or anything, I'm trying to cut that sludge out.
Yeah.
Completely.
Well, you'll feel a lot better.
Yeah. It's already starting. I mean, definitely, it's already starting.
Yeah.
I'm trying to eat kind of Mediterranean, a lot of olive oil and fish and feta and chickpeas, stuff like that. So I sent a tweet yesterday. I was at the salad bar and I was angry at the architecture of the salad bar because they put the chickpeas at the end, and by the time you get to the end, your salad has a very kind of Aztec pyramid shape. It's not pointed at the top, but it's like an Aztec pyramid. It's kind of flat, and so you cannot put chickpeas on that arrangement. They need to put the chickpeas at the beginning when you've got a flat bed there, because I get the ridiculous little tiny spoons they put in there, and I scoop it, and I put, and they just roll off like marbles and land all over the floor. And right. I'm embarrassed, so it's like, god damn, I can't have any chickpeas in the salad. And I don't want to be that guy that, because there's people behind me, I don't want to have to run down to one end of the salad bar and do this, this ingredient, this ingredient, and then run back to the start. Oh, excuse me, sorry, pardon me. And then when I get back to the table, the waitress says, "Did you find everything all right up there?" What am I going to say? No, could you? I've got this rare disease where I can't recognize a tomato. Can you come to the? Can you hold my hand? Can you take me up to the salad bar and point out the tomatoes for me? That's a push pull. That's a restaurant push pull. Did you find everything okay? What am I going to say? No, I didn't find the spare rib.
Right.
Up there, where are the spare ribs?
Now, are you one of these these freaks who scoops in the the macaroni salad or the potato salad as or the coleslaw as part of your salad?
Yeah. Yeah,
you do that? I mean, what is that?
No. Oh, God, no.
Oh, okay.
Not belong on a standard salad bar. I don't understand that at all.
Well, yeah. I mean, because what I don't understand, I mean, I can understand going back with a smaller dish or even the empty salad plate and then lumping in the and having a helping of macaroni salad or whatever the other sort of non-salad ingredients are that they invariably put there. It's like putting a big dollop of – they put the chocolate pudding in with the salad bar. I'm not going to put a big scoop of chocolate pudding with, And I don't quite grasp that, because if it's all in a salad bowl
– yeah.
It all, it's touching, and then, okay, now, see, now.
No, I don't do any of the only post-salad return I do is if they've got Waldorf salad up there, which Ruby Tuesday usually does, which I love. I love Waldorf, love a good Waldorf salad, and they make a pretty good one. So, but no, I would never mix in, the lettuce-based salad apparatus with the mayonnaise based, whether it's potato salad or anything else, not down it. Not one of those guys.
Yeah. In the case of that, separate but equal, I think is the rule of thumb.
Yeah, segregation a good thing, in your salad bar. And Ruby Tuesday is really the only decent salad bar in the world now, apparently. There used to be a place when I lived in Texas called Super Salad. S-O-U-P-E-R, super.
What?
Just clever, ding, ding, super salad. And it was unbelievable. I would eat there every single day. It was unbelievable. It was just nothing but a soup and salad bar. And the salad bar was like the length of a football field. I mean, they had everything on earth on the salad bar. It was the best. I don't understand why those aren't, why they don't have more of those. Because I get tired of Ruby Tuesdays.
Well, see, now that we have the giant grocery stores here that have the salad bar. I mean, most of the grocery stores have the salad bar.
But see, I live 45 minutes away from that place, so you can't a salad only maintains its structural integrity for about 10 minutes if you get everything on there, and then by the time you get it home, you know, 45-50 minute drive, it's just turned into it's just congealed. It's all the parts have locked together in some way that's horrible. And the lettuce is I can't do that.
So the important factor in all of this equation here is, yes, is, and you made no secret about this because you tweeted about this. You're still popping open bottles of Stoli with, you know, a power wrench, you know.
I stick them in the freezer and then I get it out, you know, come once the daughter's in bed and safely asleep to not be awake during my alcoholism, you know, during my intoxication. I take the bottle out of the freezer and I'm like, twist off. It would not budge. It had this little serrated thing at the bottom, and I'm like, and I'm trying to thaw it. I ran it under hot water, and I'm not a weak man. I'm certainly not, you know, I'm not like you. I'm not a power cyclist and 12 feet tall, but I'm like, so I'm like, God damn it, son of a, I'm just, because I just want to drink. Oh my God, I just want to drink.
You've got
to cracking the neck of this thing over my marble countertop and just being done with it.
Just,
you know, just
desperate. You know, looking all sweaty and yellow like Nicolas Cage and Leaving Las Vegas, just dying, man.
So I go to my small toolbox under the kitchen sink, and of course none of my pliers, needle nose pliers, are in there, but that won't help me at all. I'm not trying to fish, you know, I'm not trying to fish the worm out of a bottle of tequila. I'm trying to open the neck of an obstinate, you know, Stoli bottle. So I go out to the garage, which is a detached, so, you know, I'm going out, it's dark, and all the animals are running up to me. Goddamn cats. Get out of here, cat. Kicking the cat in the ass. And I'm going through my, out in the garage with the spiders and the fucking snakes. And I finally find my channel locks. And I come inside and put the channel locks on. And I'm like, oh Christ.
Good God.
Have I sunk so low? I'm like Paul Giamatti in Sideways, drinking that rare bottle of wine with his hamburger at the fast food place. It's just pathetic. I cracked that fucker open, and it felt like just drinking it right out of the bottle.
Yeah, that's right. You just dump, just pour. You don't even drop the pliers. You just, it's right in your mouth.
Yeah. Oh yeah, my God. And then I'm like, what else? I'm looking for something else I can brutalize with these pliers.
Oh, you know, my God.
Just find me something else I can exert my manhood over with these channel locks. Yeah, me and channel locks go way back. You know what a channel lock is? You know channel locks?
No, I don't, and it's, I'm like kind of a tool guy.
It's like a large, you would recognize it. It's got kind of a bird looking head, and it's a pair of pliers with just different channels, different locking channels in it.
Yeah.
And my, I used to work, God help me, I used to be a construction worker. I used to be a pipe fitter. Anybody that knows me, anybody that would just look at me with a blank stare when I, you know, what? Because I got to the site on the first day, and the guy's like, the foreman, who is the biggest douche on earth, he goes, can you turn a wrench? I'm like, yeah, I can turn it. Sure. And he hands me these channel locks. And the first time I'd ever seen a channel lock in my life. And I just stare at it like he just handed me, you know, like the shrunken skull of a pygmy tribe in South America somewhere. I'm like, what the fuck do I do with these? So here's how good a construction worker I am. My mantra for about the first month was, righty tighty, lefty loosey. I'm the only construction worker on earth who has to say righty tighty, lefty loosey.
And you're saying it out loud. Yeah, you're like actually speaking it.
Oh, I did the first time, and that was the last time that I ever said it out loud. Then they put me on a ladder. So what we had to do was hang a steel pipe, very heavy steel pipe, from the ceilings of garages. So this was industrial fire sprinklers, and in the garages it's all steel pipe, and up in the condos it's all PVC. The PVC was easy. I could actually do that. Not very fat. Like, my colleagues could do an entire floor in the time it would take me to do like one unit, but I'd do it real pretty. You know, it would really look nice. But otherwise, you know, my colleagues are, my coworkers up there just laying an entire floor. But we're down in the garage. I'm up on a 12-foot ladder, at the top of a 12-foot ladder, with a Ryobi drill with a handle on it, you know, with a real it's one of those pounding drills, right? Yeah. One of those hammer drills. I'm up on this ladder with this hammer drill, and I'm boring a hole through the cement roof of this garage, this parking garage. And my boss goes, he's down below me, 12 feet below me. He goes, "Watch out for that rebar." And I was like, "What the fuck?" I said, "What is rebar? What do you mean, watch out?" I was like, "I've got this drill bit a quarter of an inch inside solid cement, and now you're saying watch out for the rebar." And I said, "What do you mean? What does that mean? Explain that to me, because I'm the kind of construction worker I got like a paperback book in my back pocket. For the slow times, I can read a book, right?" And it was another coworker came up to me, and I was reading, and he goes, "Yeah, I just read a book the other day. It was it's called In Cold Blood by Truman Capote." I'm like, "Oh yeah, Truman Capote. I love him." So that's the level of,
right.
That's the literature level. I'm drilling, and he goes, "Watch out for the rebar." Apparently, what he wants to tell me while I'm on a 12-foot ladder with a drill bit buried in cement is that if I accidentally cut a piece of rebar, which you know what rebar is, I do now, but it's, you know, high tensile steel cable, basically, that they lay in under in between cement slabs to give it that, you know, if you're on a parking garage and you feel the kind of shimmy in it, you know, how the cement will kind of move, it's because of that rebar. But when they put it in there, they you know, stretch it real tight, so it's got this thousands of foot pounds of pressure in its, you know, in its bones, in the rebar. And he's like, "Yeah, you drilled through that rebar. You accidentally hit a piece of rebar and you cut it in half, that thing will snap and it'll cut your head off." And I'm like, "What?" I'm at the top of this ladder with this drill. And I, "What? Are you kidding me?" So before, when I was going with this drill, I was going blah, 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 blah. Now I'm going bloop, bloop, bloop. You know, I'm like touching the trigger. Like, "Oh my God, all I can think about now is rebar." And he's like, "No, you got to put your shoulder into it, boy." The very first time, that same time, I did hit a piece of rebar, but I was drilling so lamely with no heart in it, that what happened was I had the handle of the drill very close to my head, because I was really having to put some ass into it, because I had no muscle tissue whatsoever. So I had it basically the grip of the drill against my shoulder, the handle above my head. I'm wearing a hard hat, which by itself is hilarious. If you've seen my hair, I mean, no, I'm a construction guy that's got moose in his hair before going to work.
Yeah, imagine like Race Banyan wearing a hard hat.
Yes, it was pitiful. I still have that hard hat, actually. It's kind of a trophy. So I'm drilling, I'm putting a little bit of ass into it, I put my shoulder into it, and because I'm so weak and girlish, the drill bit stops dead in the rebar, which, when the drill bit stops and you're not powerful enough to hold your drill, the drill itself will rotate, not the bit, but the drill.
Yeah.
So this very, very Laurel and Hardy-esque, I'm drilling and the bit stops, the drill spins so powerfully that the handle comes around, does about 180 degrees, hits me in the head, and knocks me off the 12-foot ladder. In my head, and knocks me off the ladder. And I fall in a heap at my boss's feet. That was like day two of my construction worker
days. And you're just laying there, righty tighty, lefty loosey.
Right. And I could go on and on. I once almost killed a Mexican with about 600 pounds of steel pipe. Almost literally drilled it into his skull.
Good Lord, you are like the journeyman. I mean, you have been everywhere. Like, Tom Hartman's got nothing on you. I mean, Tom Hartman has done every job. But you're like Gump. I mean, you're just like, my God.
Yeah. And I'm the Zelig of the comedy radio world, yes.
And I'm debating which is funny, your construction injuries or your alcoholism.
Well, at one point they went hand in hand. Yeah, I was extremely inept at that job. You had to, at one point I was responsible for an entire line of central pipe, which is the steel pipe that runs down the middle of a corridor. We were piping this retirement community for retired Air Force people in Northern Virginia, out there in Leesburg, west of the DC area.
Yeah.
And they were building this massive, it's called Falcon's Landing. It's still there, but God help the residents if there's a fire. God help you. If any Falcon's Landing residents are listening to today, please don't ever start a fire, because you will burn to death given the job that we did on these sprinklers in your house. On each floor, you run a line of 3-inch steel pipe down the middle of the corridor, and then all of your PVC branches off from that. So I was in charge of this whole steel pipe line, and that means putting on couplers and these rubber flanges and screwing all this stuff in. And I did that, and then finally, once you get it all sealed up, you put water on it to see if it holds, and then you go around and find leaks. It's not so much that you had to go around and find leaks with me, as you had to stand right by the main, and as soon as you put water on it, get ready to shut it off, because my job, the work I did was so subpar that as soon as they put water on that fucker, the last coupling, which is this giant nipple basically that you put on the end of this pipe, blew off with such force that it shot straight through the drywall behind the pipe. It was like a catapult. They put all this water pressure on it, and this giant steel nipple goes flying off, crashes through the drywall, and water is just pouring out of this 3-foot three-inch pipe. That's so God help you, Falcon's Landing residents, if there's a fire.
So, yeah, I mean, I just keep thinking of this Three Stooges clip that I keep posting in the context of the oil spill. The Three Stooges, A Plumbing We Will Go, which is the only Three Stooges thing. I'm not a big Three Stooges fan. I like the Marx Brothers. Not much into the Three Stooges, but there's that one short where they're actually fixing the plumbing at this mansion, and it's reminding me a lot of the oil spill. And it's like Curly has actually caged himself into this network of pipes that he's made, and he's stuck inside of this cube. It looks like a Borg cube, and he's in there. But my God.
So the oil spill, is that still going on? Is that still a problem?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And now we're talking about nuking it. Although I think they should just take that, whatever the tool you use to open up your bottle of Stoli, and just go down there and wrench it closed. But no, they're actually thinking about dropping I don't know. The government isn't thinking about doing this, because I think it's insane, but there's this growing sort of conversation. Well, the Soviets did it.
Mm.
Why shouldn't we? Yeah, the Soviets, who were so excellent at controlling nuclear energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're experts. Yeah. It's just the American way. You get angry at something, you can't solve something. Nuke it.
That's right. Just blow it up.
Just blow it up. Destroy it. Yeah, this thing's gonna go on and on. There's probably no end in sight in the near term, and I don't understand. Like the Maureen Dowd, did you see that Maureen Dowd horseshit the other day? What do they want the government to do? I mean, what is it that government can do that these so-called experts, you know, that should have a plan for this, you know, aren't doing? I just don't get it.
Well, yeah, I mean, and not to make this all about me, I never do that.
No.
But, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I posted something on the blog. It's just like, you know what, I think the White House is missing an opportunity here. And their language is too cozy with BP. I mean, I think it's David Axelrod appeared on Hardball or something like that. And he was like, well, we're working with BP, and, you know, Stephen Chu, he's down there and he's doing the thing. And I was kind of like, well, this is a little conciliatory and nice for a situation where I think a lot of people are really kind of pissed off at BP right now.
Yeah.
And so I felt that, well, you know what? I think this language is tone deaf. I think they need to sound a little angrier. But now I feel ridiculous, because the corporate press and especially the cable news people and of course Maureen Dowd have kind of taken that. They didn't take it from me, but I mean they've taken this This idea that the president needs to get pissed off and extrapolated it to this extreme level where I don't know what they're expecting him to do. I mean, they want him to go on television and cry or,
right,
you know,
right, pound like, his fist or, you know.
Right. I think Jon Stewart did had a Photoshop of the president scrubbing a duck or whatever it was.
Scrubbing a pelican. Yeah, that was funny.
Scrubbing a duck.
Scrubbing a duck.
Yeah, scrubbing a pelican in this thing. Do they expect him to do that? Do they expect him to shut down every White House event for this? And when he does, are they going to say, well, you know what? He's spending a lot of time on the oil spill. And, you know, that's going to continue till August, maybe December. Yeah. He ought to be concentrating on jobs, jobs.
Right.
You know, yeah. I mean, let's face it. I mean, my daughter actually just signed up on Twitter. And she tweeted, one of her first tweets to me was, is it me or is there just a lot of crap going on right now in the world? And I said, yeah. Absolutely. And aren't you glad you're not the president right now?
Oh, my God. I know. He just, you know, you can't buy a break with this administration. It's just the things you don't foresee. And that, you know, that's my whole thing about your government has to treat the world, just everything like you're preparing for a disaster at home, like with the little nest egg, a little emergency money. It's, you know, these two wars and everything we got going on. Where is disaster preparedness? Because now we've got, you know, the multiple states of, federal disaster areas along the Gulf. That's, and I say, I heard that on NPR the other day about them declaring, you know, disaster areas and asking for federal funds. I'm like, federal funds? That should be BP money, man.
Yeah.
Why, if you cause, I can understand federal disaster relief for, you know, force majeure, for Katrina, for things like that, that are just out of anyone's, you know, control. But I don't see a dime of federal money in disaster relief coming from, you know, from taxpayers when the cause is this behemoth, this corporation.
They're not
come out of their ass.
BP is not going to spend any more money than they absolutely necessarily have to, and that's the problem with BP running the show. They're making decisions based on cost benefit analysis. They're making decisions on making sure that their losses are as minimal as possible and their gains as large as possible. I mean, they're harvesting this oil. They've harvested barrels upon barrels, thousands of barrels of oil from the leaking oil. Okay, so they're making calculations based on the corporate bottom line. But I want to go back to this press thing for a second. And here's how I relate to this. Now, those of you who are married can kind of relate to this. You know, like your wife comes in, she's got kind of a sad look on her face. Something's, you know, she had a conversation with a friend or something happened at work and it's, she comes in and you're kind of, you know, it's like me. I'm always hammering away on the internet, you know, just doing something and kind of a little bit distracted. And she comes up, aren't you going to ask me why I'm so down? And then you know, it's like, okay, why are you down? You know what I mean? Yeah. And then it seems so prompted and fake. That's exactly what's going to happen. They're going to say, you know, Aren't you going to go down there to the Gulf Coast? Aren't you going to, you know, pretend to be sympathetic? And then once he does and he goes down there, it's just going to look like he's doing it because they manipulated him into doing it.
Yeah. It's just, there's no win here. There's absolutely no upside to any of this except the tangential upside of the Haley Barbers of the world opening their mouths in ways sympathetic to BP. I mean, that's the only, the only upside. CNN, you posted a thing yesterday about CNN doing the bright side of the oil spill. You know, this false equivalency, even on an oil spill.
Right.
I mean, it's like, what's next? Holocaust, good or bad? You know, it's like, what? Oh, my God. We're going there now. We're going to the bright side of the oil spill.
Well, there's this congressman, Don Young, right?
Yeah.
He said the other day, this is not an environmental disaster. And I will say that again and again, because it is such a national phenomena. Oil has seeped into the ocean for centuries. will continue to do it. During World War II, there was over 10 million barrels of oil spilt from ships and no natural catastrophe. Mm. We will lose some birds. We will lose some fixed sea life. But overall, it'll recover.
Mm. He's awesome. He's from Alaska.
Yeah, he's a smarty.
Oh, that's...
He's a smarty. And on,
from Alaska, from a country, you know, from a state that's gone through this whole, you know, gone through this heartbreak
right.
before, and he's that's his opinion. That's awesome.
Well, of course, he's
you know, Alaska couldn't be more removed from the actual disaster. That's the thing. Here in Nebraska, nobody cares about it. You know, it's a Gulf Coast problem. It's you know, it's not our issue. There's no rage. Again, there's no real rage about this.
Right. Well, then, you know, he's obviously just parroting Rush Limbaugh, who has been saying
it's natural. Oil's natural.
Yeah, it's natural. Like a brain tumor is natural.
Yeah. There's nothing. Am I the only? There's nothing wrong with it. It's natural.
Erectile dysfunction, natural.
Oil, it'll take care of itself.
Yeah. I mean, Rush Limbaugh says here, oil is as much part of nature as air is. Oil is as much part of nature as water is. If we didn't do anything, it would recover. It might take a lot of years, but it would recover. The earth is an amazing thing. Now, I'm not suggesting anything other than trying to present you a fact. Ugh. See, this is, the oil is supposed to be under the ground, right?
Right.
In these prospects, in these giant underground wells, you know, and that's where it's supposed to remain. If suddenly we let all that oil out, it would be very bad. And I want to see how natural Limbaugh thinks it is when it starts washing up in Palm Beach on his private beach.
You know, dinosaurs were natural in its day, but the Earth decided they couldn't really handle them anymore. Killed the shit out of them. So, you know, the Earth is an amazing place. And I think someday it's going to get highly pissed at us. And there's just going to be some real interesting, some pushback. I think we're going to get a little bit of pushback.
You know what's natural is plutonium.
It's shiny. It has large, shiny isotopes.
Well, I mean, you know,
that love your soft tissue and organs.
We've got two nuclear power plants that are leaking radioactive isotopes into drinking water. We got one in New Jersey, in South Jersey, and then also one in Vermont. Mm. I mean, literally. I mean, it's leaking in the one in Vermont. I think the concentration of this one isotope is 100 times the acceptable level, according to the EPA. And we know how stringent the EPA is.
Yeah. Yeah, they're on the job.
And so, I mean, this is all evidence to me that, you know, there needs to be, certainly there are going to be reforms. And there's going to be increased regulations. But it needs to be almost a societal change. If there's, yeah, and I know CNN was kind of looking, let's look at the bright side of the oil spill. Well, if there is going to be a bright side, I'm hoping that it will be sort of a national embracing of regulating these oil and energy companies.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's going to happen. But I mean, it would be nice if it would, because you add these reforms, and then the next Republican jagoff who gets elected president is just going to roll them all back again.
Yeah.
And
I'm hoping this, and you seemed a little less optimistic about it, but I'm hoping this, you know, Eric Holder's, the Justice Department's investigation into, you know, criminal negligence and everything else. I hope that has long enough. I hope he gets all Ken Starr on that bitch, because Ken Starr was able to take, you know, one little thing, one nonsensical, no zero issue thing, and turn it into an impeachment. I want to see Eric Holder get all Ken Starr up on this ass and roll it all the way back to the day that Cheney sat down in that dark room you know, with with in the Batcave, where he had his secret energy meeting, and right. really get to the bones of that, and what was it that they decided that, you know, because I see it as one of those Simpsons like meetings where Mr. Burns and Dracula and everybody are down there, and they're all just like, oh, you know, just deregulate, and they're killing a virgin on a stone, and they're drinking her blood, and,
right.
you know, that's how I want to get back to that meeting. I want to see the minutes of that meeting. I want to see somebody's phone video of that meeting. That's what I hope all this ends up with.
Yeah, it won't happen.
I mean,
I was looking back, and you know, we should have Shannon Moore on one of these days, and
yeah,
because she is just a complete expert when it comes to obviously the Exxon Valdez oil spill and how it relates to this this current oil spill. And you know, one of the things that if you read back in the history of the Exxon Valdez, which isn't really history because I mean they were still appealing the fines and the fees as recently as 2008, 2009. It's 2008, I think it was in the Supreme Court. I mean, this is a company, and there's no reason to believe that BP is going to be any different. You know?
I don't know.
I mean, the Justice Department could slap them with all kinds of fines. They'll just appeal for a decade, more,
sure.
two decades, appeal, until it gets whittled down to nothing. I think the initial judgment was something like, you know, it was in two pieces. There was one that was in the hundreds of millions range. And then there was like this $5 billion judgment against Exxon.
Yeah.
Well, they appealed it and they appealed it and they appealed it until that amount became so ridiculously small that, you know, it was basically, you know, for an oil giant, it's just, yeah. you know, it's like pocket change.
It's a $1.95 and one of those tiger tails you can hang out of your gas tank.
Right. And anything else, any other damages they had to pay, we're all covered by insurance.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, so Exxon clearly felt no impact.
Yeah.
From the Valdez. Yeah, we all boycotted Exxon for, you know, 2 months. Yeah. After the Valdez, and then we got, wow, this is really inconvenient.
Yeah,
I gotta.
Yeah, because I got an Exxon charge card, man. I gotta go there.
Yeah, it's right there, and it's right there, and it's right there. It's on the way to work. It's on yeah. this side of the road. It's not. I want to go to Sunoco. I gotta cross. Are you kidding me? So you know, we yeah. all went back to buying gas from Exxon, and this is the same thing is going to happen with BP. I mean, are you? These guys are going to spend a pile of cash on a PR campaign, on commercials, oh, yeah. Whitewashing this whole thing. I mean, it's so predictable. Yeah. It's so predictable, and so I mean, the only real punishment is the punishment that's not going to happen. They're not going to be put into receivership. They're not going to be broken up. They're not going to be shut down.
Yeah.
That is a fact. BP yeah. will continue to exist. They will continue to prosper. Until there is no more petroleum, BP will still be making record profits quarter in, quarter out. Yeah, they've lost a bunch of their value on the stock market recently. But that's all going to come back.
Yeah.
That's all going to come back when this sort of, when we get bored with this, when it becomes more interesting to talk about American Idol, it'll all be back to normal and BP. Right. BP? Oh, well, whatever.
Yeah.
It's yeah. There's a BP right near my house, and it's on the way to the store, so.
Yep. No, we have very, very short memories in this country.
Yeah.
Except for the things that we misremember, the bullshit memories. We keep those going for hundreds of years, but the important stuff now, it's, you know, like you said, American Idol, more important.
Well, speaking of bullshit memories.
Uh-oh.
Sarah Palin chokes on history once
again.
Yep.
Oh, no.
Sarah Palin, we have this ongoing segment now. I guess it's becoming a regular segment.
Sarah Palin chokes on history. As long as she keeps providing it, yeah.
Right, and it happens every week. But now, I mean, she's actually choking on recent history the last couple of weeks. It's not so much, oh, the founding fathers were all, you know, evangelical Christians. No, it's not that. Or it's not the Constitution was basically like the Bible, only shorter.
Yeah.
It's not that. I mean, she is actually choking on her own history of things that she has said. Here's this tweet from Sarah Palin this week. Extreme greenies. By the way, her tweets are almost illegible. I mean, it's like if there's like bad handwriting in print, this would be her tweets. Just bad handwriting.
It's like Piper writes them. It's like Piper's job at the at the compound there is to just tweet for mommy.
Right. Extreme Greeny, see now why we push drill baby drill of known reserves and promising finds in safe onshore places like Anwar. Do you get it? So basically what she's saying is we only push drill baby drill for onshore places.
Yeah,
we weren't for the drill baby drill in offshore places.
Oh, Christ.
So, of course, we have a wide variety of clips and, quotes of her saying, yes, offshore drilling. I mean, that was the whole... I mean, you remember back to the summer of 2008, leading up to the Republican convention, the whole idea was to open up offshore drilling because gas prices were through the roof. And that was John McCain's ridiculous idea that suddenly if we start drilling offshore, suddenly we're going to have all
leases.
This.
It was all about opening these, these new leases and doing the exploration offshore. I don't remember Anwar coming up once.
Right. But it was all about offshore drilling, and then suddenly we would have all this gasoline, and suddenly we would be, paying, 99 cents a gallon.
Yeah.
Which is just the most ridiculous thing in the world, because any new exploration offshore would take about 10 years to produce any oil, and only then it would only produce a few years worth of natural gas and oil.
She still hasn't figured out that, that there are digital archives of the things she has said and done. She still doesn't realize that she thinks that her bubble is, a 24-hour thing. And as soon as she gets through the day, then she's like, phew, all the written and recorded records of everything I just said, gone forever.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's, well, I think again, much like Fox News, I think she believes that the true believers will not look it up. They won't care to look it up. I mean, of course,
that's 100% true.
Right.
That's what I'm starting to do now on my answers to Wingnut mailbag when I get them in town here is, there was this long one about separation of church and state and about how pious and Christian the founders were.
Right.
And it would start with a little bit of nugget of truth, and then they'll throw in a quote, and I'll go out and I'll look and can find no actual historical record of that quote ever being said. So now I'm going to start offering bounties. I'm going to literally tell these people, I will give you $100 in cash for every one of these quotes that you give me that you can source, that you can give me a primary source, meaning a collection of their writings. I will give you money. I will pay you if you can source these quotes. That's the only way I can think to get through to these people, to get them to do their own research.
Right.
Because they just get these emails and they pass them on, and it's informing the way they vote. It's informing their civic duty, and that's criminal to me. That none of it is true, and they won't do any of the due diligence to see if, wow, boy, that does sound like something I should have learned in school. Why wasn't that in my textbook?
Right.
No, they just immediately pick it up, and that's, now that's the new truth. And it's criminal.
Right.
Internet sucks for that.
Right. And you can rattle off all of the quotes that you want. It doesn't matter. I mean, here's Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin, October 21st, 2008. And we will develop clean coal technology, and we will safely drill for the billions of barrels of oil that we have underground, including offshore. Then the day before, in Loveland, Colorado, and whether Joe Biden approves it or not, we will develop clean coal technology, and we will safely drill for the billions of barrels of oil that are warehoused underground, including our offshore sources. Drill, baby, drill, drill, baby, drill. Three days before that, in Westchester, Ohio. It also means safely tapping into our offshore sources, safely, environmentally safe, she says. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Greta Van Susteren on May 14th asks her, in the meantime, though, until we get to the bottom of it, you think we should continue to go full speed ahead with offshore drilling? Palin responds, absolutely. Even until we get to the bottom of this? Absolutely. This is last month, May 14th of last month.
Yeah.
She was promoting offshore drilling. But yet yesterday she says, extreme greenies, see now why we push drill baby drill of known reserves and promising finds in safe onshore places like Anwar. Oh, she's so full of shit. I mean, it's unbelievable.
But there's just there's no calling her on it. I mean, there's no way to get that back into the bubble. I mean, the bubble flows in one direction.
I mean, whether data only
flows out.
Yeah. I mean, and this has just been ongoing. Andrew Sullivan's done a great job in tracking the odd lies of Sarah Palin. There's the bridge to nowhere and the aerial hunting. And she has no regard for even trying to appear consistent or honest.
Yeah. Yeah.
Honest. But then wait, it's both sides. Because there'll be some jagoff on the left who said one thing about his military service. Well, they're all lying. Well, no, it's different. It's not the same. It's a false, you know. So,
yeah.
But that's Sarah Palin chokes on history for this week.
She's smart.
Yeah. Before we wrap up the show, I wanted to get to this real quick. I was kind of caught between two of my favorite people in the whole world last week.
Oh no!
You're Don Geronimo. if you're not familiar with Don Geronimo, he's the host of the Don and Mike show in Washington D.C. and they were syndicated around the country for many, many years there. And I actually worked for that show for a couple of years and grew up listening to Don and Mike, as did you. And so you know, Don is on Twitter now. Yeah. His handle being Don Geronimo Show. Mm-hmm. And so he's been tweeting quite a bit lately now because he's finally going to be back on the air, this time in Sacramento and, obviously streamed on the internet and so on.
Yeah. So, which is funny because on the old show, they used to just make merciless fun of Sacramento, the big
right.
sack.
The big
I mean, it was their number one, target for just mocking Sacramento at the time, but
right.
he has since recanted all of his anti-Sacramento sentiment.
Exactly, but he was—I forget what exactly it was—he was tweeting. But you evidently thought he was drunk because you tweeted back to him. You said, "Jesus, Don, how drunk are you right now? Maybe get Bart to tweet for you." Bart is Don Geronimo's son.
Yeah.
Maybe get Bart to tweet for you. Don Geronimo replied.
Yeah, he got me. No,
okay, well, let's see. Now, I wasn't following Twitter at this time, so I didn't catch this until I get a message from you suggesting I get this message saying, yeah, hey, your old boss Don Geronimo show is mad at me because I'm a douche and an ass. Patch this up for me, please. And I'm going, oh my God, what did he say?
It wasn't even
what
that bad.
What did he say to Don?
I was drunk.
He says, "Jesus, Don,
I was the drunk one."
Right? How drunk are you, Don? And let's be honest. I mean, yeah, I kind of thought, you know, I hate to be ambivalent about this, but I can see both sides.
No, I was a complete douche. That was just I just fired that off. I had already been liquored up for about an hour and just trying to get his goat because I've tweeted at him many, many times with no response. So I thought this was just another one. And I found that the best way to get somebody's attention tweet-wise who isn't following you is to piss them off.
Right.
And then you come back and you go, oh, ha, ha, ha. And then all is well. And then you've made a friend.
So, yeah.
It didn't work out that way.
So you're sitting there in a puddle of your own filth, surrounded by power tools
and
broken bottles
that.
Of Stoli. And tweeting away at Don Geronimo, accusing everyone else of drinking. So
yes.
Don replies to you. So you basically say, how drunk are you right now? To Don, basically accusing him of writing illegible tweets. So he responds, oh, I see. You mistake a typo for me being drunk. Tell you what, DM me your cell, and I will call you the next time I'm drunk. Ass.
He calls me ass. Oh, I was crushed by that.
Oh, my. Yeah, well, I can only imagine. Because, you know, I was just, I was feeling sympathetic for you because I was right on the heels of my own sort of Twitter crushing when I discovered that Lance Armstrong blocked me. You know, I mean, here I am. I'm like sticking my neck out and defending the guy vigorously, not only on Twitter, but also on the Huffington Post. You know, Lance Armstrong is not, just because he's excellent at bike riding doesn't mean he's automatically doping. There's no evidence. No evidence, you know, and of course, you know, so I start tweeting these things, you know, thinking that, okay, he's going to understand the funny behind this. He's going to understand how silly it is. There are a lot of people on the internet right now who have like, they have that one bit of evidence proving that Lance Armstrong is a doper, that he was using all varieties of performance-enhancing drugs. Mm-hmm. Then they've got the one. They've got a text message that from Lance Armstrong sent to Frankie Andreu saying, hey, come on down. Let's get some steroids or whatever the fuck. And they've got that evidence. So I was kind of satirizing those people, those guys on the internet who believe they've got the one bit of evidence that proves Lance Armstrong's guilt. And so I was going, oh, yeah, Lance Armstrong was the second shooter in the grassy knoll. Guilty! I said, Lance Armstrong faked the moon landing in his basement. Guilty! And then suddenly I go and discover that Lance Armstrong has blocked me.
Oh.
And I'm wondering, why is this? Because, you know, on a couple of them, I put his Twitter handle. So if he was looking at his RTs, he'd see it, right?
Right, right.
So I think, oh, well, maybe he'd find this funny, and I'll just throw this in there, and, you know.
Yeah, maybe you're cutting it a little too close to the truth there. Maybe he did have something to do with
it. Maybe he did.
The fake moon landing.
Maybe he did.
Maybe he was on the grassy knoll.
That's right. I said something about how he launched his cycling career in the basement of Bill Ayer's house, right? And maybe it's just went and he's, you know, he went to the church of Reverend Wright. Boom. Uh-oh, guilty. Boom. Guilty. But then he blocked me. Which I didn't care for. You know, suffice to say, I wasn't following him at the time. I unfollowed all of the cycling people I was following because they're constantly spoiling the race results.
Oh, right.
So I during the duration of the Tour of Italy, I stopped following all of them. And when I went to go start following them again, I dialed up Lance Armstrong and on Twitter and went to follow him. Blocked!
Blocked!
You're blocked! So,
shunned!
You were crushed by Don Geronimo. I was.
He called me an ass, but then I said that. I said, you know, I'll give you if you follow me, I'll give you my cell phone, and you can call me all you want.
Right. But and you did tweet him again recently, right?
No.
Oh, you didn't.
No. Oh. He called me an ass. We're through.
Oh, okay. Because I saw another thing that you had maybe replied to him about.
Oh, maybe I did. Yeah, but I don't know.
Yeah, you forgot.
I was probably drunk.
Stoli. Stoli. I don't even understand what this tweet even means. It said, from now on, I'm giving up Elvis Dengeldine and I'm going for Education. Pow.
It was a response to he sent out a list of crazy DJ names, and my favorite was Education. That one was great. Education.
What is it? Drew Peacock.
Drew Peacock, yeah. Drew Peacock. Yeah.
Right.
That's awesome.
Hey, thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Drive safely. Fudge with us. Fudge with the best. Back next week. Bob and Neville Show on the iClips Network. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.